From Psalm 91, beginning in verse 1, this is the word of the Lord. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and buckler. You will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only look with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord your dwelling place, the Most High, who is my refuge, no evil shall be allowed to befall you, no plague come near your tent. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. You will tread on the lion and the adder, the young lion and the serpent you will trample underfoot. Because he holds fast to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls to me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With long life, I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. This has been the reading of God's word. Please be seated. I don't know if there is a more beautiful, soul-nourishing passage in the Bible than Psalm 91. So I was thinking about what to preach this morning with kind of Christmas wrapping up, heading into the new year. I do like to at least throw in one sermon that maybe kind of brings us back to the fundamentals, brings us back to this solid foundation of who God is and our need of what God is for us. And this is one of those times in the year where it's helpful to do such a thing. But again, what is more beautiful and soul-nourishing than Psalm 91? To stop and meditate on he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. Beautiful because it gives words, maybe words that we don't have in ourselves, words that we wouldn't naturally produce, but it gives us words to our deepest longings of rest, of shelter, of contentment. It's like after a long journey, we found our way back home into the shadow of his wings. When do you need to hear these words? A church father named Athanasius, who lived in the 300s, he wrote a letter to a fellow pastor, and he said, you know, go to Psalm 91 for the following reasons. You want to sing Psalm 91 when you need to build up your confidence and trust in the Lord. Well, when do you need to do that? When do you and I need to build up our confidence and trust in the Lord? Isn't the answer like always? We always need to do that. Athanasius said, recite this psalm in order to be reoriented away from the fears of this world and devoted to God. That's a great way of describing all of our lives and all of our everyday experiences, right? Here are all the fears that we face, and yet this is a psalm that says, but there is one greater than our fears. And he said, recite the psalm when you want to live as a Christian. Recite Psalm 91 when you want to live as a Christian. Remember, the Protestant Reformation followed the Renaissance, which was a turn to the sources. And so everyone that went to university at the time of the Renaissance, they would study their Latin and their Greek. And one prominent Hebrew scholar, and you can imagine not many scholars of Hebrew existed in the 16th century, but one prominent Hebrew scholar that influenced a lot of the reformers, he said the following: it would not be difficult to persuade the reader that we have no poem, either in Greek or Latin, comparable to this Hebrew ode. All of the great Latin and Greek poems, and there are a lot of great ones, maybe they all pale in comparison to the beauty of Psalm 91. Psalm 91 is powerful because it gets to the heart of who we are as men and women, struggling to trust God, struggling to find our confidence in God in light of the real world in which we live. This psalm forces us to ask, what are my fears? Is it the terror of the night or the arrow that flies by day? Is it the pestilence that stalks in darkness or destruction that wastes at noonday? You know what pestilence is, right? It's sickness, it's disease. Do we have such different fears in this day and age? Maybe we would add, what fears do we have for our children? That's a good way to think about our fears. We fear failure. We fear loneliness. We fear death. What are all of the fears? Think about right now as you sit here. What are the fears that keep you up at night? What are the fears that you were always thinking about? Think about them, because Psalm 91 meets us in our fears. Not to leave us there, but to bring us to God, who is our refuge and shelter. Psalm 91 meets us in our fears, but not to leave us there. It brings us to God, who is our refuge and shelter. This morning, we'll work our way through this psalm, and we'll look at how the Lord first calls us to trust in him. He secondly confirms that he indeed is trustworthy. And then third, he condescends to us in mercy and grace. And so the Lord calls, the Lord confirms, and the Lord condescends. First of all, the Lord calls us to trust in him. I'm getting this from the first two verses of this psalm, Psalm 91. So verses 1 and 2 call us, right? He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to you, the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. We don't know the original context of Psalm 91. We don't know if Moses wrote it. Moses wrote Psalm 90. There's a reason Psalm 90 and 91 are next to each other in the way that the Psalms are compiled. But we don't know if Moses wrote it. We don't know if this is a Psalm of David. David, of course, wrote so many of our Psalms. Were these the words from a priest, from a worship leader, to a newly anointed king to be grounded in God? These are good words for a king, aren't they? You are not the refuge. You are not the shelter. You are not the help. You are not the deliverer. The Lord is our refuge and our shelter. These are great words for a king, you can imagine. Were these words sung out over Israel's army before proceeding into battle? God is your refuge and shelter. Is it merely a kind of general song for Israel in light of living in a world that can be hard, in a world that can be hostile, in a world that can be tumultuous? And maybe it's because we don't know the original context, and maybe it's because it's anonymous that Psalm 91 feels timeless. It feels accessible. It feels like something generation after generation can return to and be grounded in. The most important aspect of regarding the context of this psalm is that it is written for lives lived in this world as this world really is. Words are sweet. The call to flee to the Lord as our refuge is profound because of the lives we live in this fallen world. See, Psalm 91 doesn't consist of disembodied, kind of pie-in-the-sky pleasantries. This isn't some ancient Near Eastern spiritual and religious greeting card. The power of these words is that they are placed on our tongues in famine. They are placed on our tongues in hard times, when pestilence stalks and when arrows fly by. The overarching theme of the Psalms isn't be faithful and you will avoid suffering and danger and difficult circumstances. It's that life consists of all of those things, but God is also present with you in them. The Lord is always with his people. God calls us to flee to him as a refuge and shelter. When do you need a refuge and shelter? Isn't it a scary and dangerous context where you need shelter? It would be pretty useless to build a storm shelter in Southern California, wouldn't it? Any of you grew up in the Midwest where you had storm shelters, you had basements that could protect you against tornadoes, and so the alarm would sound, and what do? You flee to the shelter. Maybe you were in certain places during the Cold War where you had bomb shelters, and so you went through these drills where the alarm would sound, and you needed to seek shelter. You needed refuge to get out from away from the danger, right? We don't have those in California. We just have fires. You have to run. And we have earthquakes, you just have to cross your fingers, hope it doesn't happen. With tornadoes, you flee. With a storm, you flee. And yet this context of life in a fallen world, it directs us to God, who isn't some giant cosmic teddy bear there to kind of stroke our heads and tell us everything is fine. We need to flee to him as a shelter and refuge in hard times, the one who is able to provide protection. The metaphors the psalmist invokes here, it draws our minds to different sorts of protection. So a shelter is a place of concealment. It's somewhere to hide from dangerous situations or people. The alarm sounds and you flee out of danger, out of harm's way, and you take cover. But God is not only our shelter and refuge, he's also our shade. He's our shade. We dwell in the shadow of the Almighty. I think one of the great promises of the new creation, all the way back in Micah chapter 4, is that every man will sit under his vine and fig tree and no one shall make them afraid. Just evoking contentment, evoking shalom, evoking peace. This past fall, my daughter had a softball game at 5 p.m. every Saturday, and where the bleachers were, the sun would just like be right on us. And it would just feel so hot. The weather was great, right? But when you're in the midst of the sun and the sun is directly aiming at you, you want to seek refuge. And so there's a sorry tree in the grassy knoll behind the bleachers, and you just want to go sit in that little strip of shade just to have some kind of refreshment from the heat. God is the shadow that we find our rest in. Besides the metaphors of protection and rest that we are offered, we also see in these first two verses, we have four different names that God has given. Four different names because it's good poetry. It'd be pretty bad poetry if it just said the same word over and over again. But it's more than just aesthetic, because we get this robust picture of who God is through his names. So verse 1, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High, Elyon. That's the name of God first introduced by that mysterious priest Melchizedek, who is priest of God Elyon, who is priest of the Most High God. What is that name revealing? It's revealing his sovereignty. It's revealing that he is above all things. He is not one of the highest. He is Most High. Everything else compares to him and is short of him. As one commentator says, Most High cuts every threat down to size. There is nothing above God. Secondly, there is a call to abide in the shadow of the Almighty, El Shaddai. El Shaddai is a name for God that goes back in particular to Lord sustaining the patriarchs. Think of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What did all of those patriarchs have in common? They basically didn't have a home. They didn't have a land. And so God was the one who preserved them. God was the one who went with them. El Shaddai was the one that gave them location. He's the one that gave them roots. Thirdly, I will say to the Lord, to Yahweh, my refuge and my fortress. This is the unique covenantal name of the Lord, right? So remember Moses at the burning bush. God elects Moses. He says, you're going to be the deliverer of my people. And Moses says, well, who am I going to tell the people who sent me? And the Lord says, you're not going to name me. I'm not going to give you some name that you can contain me. I am who I am, and I will be who I will be. But what's most remarkable about this name, where God says, I am existence itself, is he says, you will not put me in a box. And then God puts himself in a box of promises. It's the most remarkable thing about the name. What should I call you? And God says, you can't call me anything, but here are all these promises I will make to you. He is the God who covenants with his people. And finally, the most generic name for the Lord, God, Elohim. What's so significant through these names is that God is my God. Even this general term for God is intimate. The psalmist reminds us to whom we call. My God is the God who is the creator of the heavens and earth, who is existence itself, and all other things in existence rely upon him and find their life from him. He's the God that sustained our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is their God of promise. He is our God of promise. He is the God who reveals himself not merely as powerful and sovereign, but as a covenantal friend. He is mine. We're reminded that God is worthy of our confidence and trust in light of his sovereign power and faithfulness and care. The names of God evoke confidence as they bring us face to face with the power of our Creator God, and they bring us to his enduring, promise-keeping love. I love how one writer summarizes these verses. He says, the supreme God is precisely the one whom the individual may call my God, as if he existed only for his sake. It's only because God is God that absolute trust in him at all is possible. First of all, we're called to place our trust in the Lord. He's capable. He's able. He can handle it. Psalm 91 proceeds from calling us to place our trust in the Lord to then the Lord confirms his faithfulness. He is trustworthy, and now he's going to build his case. This section makes up the bulk of Psalm 91 and details how God will protect his people and also explain how he is capable of doing it. And so in verses 3 through 6, in what stands in for just about every kind of threat, we have both human and natural trials. So like an animal being hunted, we're told the Lord will deliver us from the snare of the fowler. We're also told that God will deliver you from deadly pestilence, which is a kind of natural trial, right? It's disease, it's sickness, it's illness. And amidst these threats, we're told God is capable of protecting us, and he's worthy of our trust. And we're given three reasons. He's like a mother bird, he's a strong shield, and he's the commander of heaven's armies. Again, as you sit here, as you think of the fears that consume you, the fears that control you, God says, here is how I am for you. Here is how I am dependable to you. I am like a mother bird, a shield, and I am the commander of heaven's armies. Let's chew on those images. Verse 4, he will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. Under his wings you will find refuge. That brings us back to the book of Deuteronomy. The Lord is establishing his people, his nation, and he is likened to a mother bird that stirs up its nest and flutters over its young, guiding them. Spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions. What's remarkable is that we have here nothing less than a maternal picture of a mother bird tenderly caring for her young. It's beautiful. Remember, God is neither male nor female. God reveals himself to us as a father. He says, address me, think of me, speak to me as a father. And yet even his fatherhood has maternal qualities, and this is one of them. Tenderness, caring. A few years ago, we had a palm tree in our side yard where we discovered a hummingbird nest. And hummingbirds already aren't very big, right? They're very small. They're fast. And so you can imagine when the chicks are born, they're so tiny and they're so vulnerable. And every day we would go out there and we would watch this mother who would so tenderly protect these eggs that eventually would hatch from all of the predators. Even in a suburban neighborhood, you can imagine all of those predators that were out to get those young hummingbirds. And there was the mother, so faithfully, so tenderly caring for her young. You can see how powerful this picture is in Scripture. The vulnerability, the weakness of little birds, that's who we are. And we're cared for by this God who spreads his wings over us. What's beautiful is that we have this juxtaposition of the Lord who covers us with his wings where we find refuge. And that's matched by the end of verse 4, where God is a shield and buckler. God's care combines the warm protectiveness of a mother bird with the hard, unyielding strength of armor. The psalmist uses these pictures of battle, right? A thousand may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only look with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked. If you remember Isaiah 9 from a couple of weeks ago, right, where you are going to enjoy the harvest of God. God did all the work, you're going to eat it. You're going to enjoy the spoils of his victory. You're just going to sit back, and God is the one who is going to be victorious for you. And so the psalmist says, all around you, your enemies will fall, and you will merely sit back like a spectator and watch God do his work. If you've ever been in a courtroom or you've watched a lot of courtroom dramas, you know the attorneys, they get before the jury, and they're presenting exhibit by exhibit. That's the case that's being laid out here for God's trustworthiness. Exhibit A, God is like a mother bird. Exhibit B, God is like a strong shield and buckler. Exhibit C, God is the host of heaven's armies. He's not done yet. Listen to these words from the reformer John Calvin on this passage, which I think is so remarkable and worth quoting at length. He says, if we tremble to think of his majesty, he presents himself to us under the lowly figure of the hen. If we're terrified at the power of our enemies and the multitude of dangers, he reminds us of his own invincible power. When even all these attempts to encourage us have been tried and he finds that we still linger and hesitate to approach him or cast ourselves upon his sole and exclusive protection, he next makes mention of the angels and proffers them as guardians of our safety. Ah, so good, right? We're people who are consumed with fear, but there's a problem. When we rightly understand God, shouldn't we fear God if he is the creator of all, if he is the king of the universe? And so God reveals himself, I am to you like a mother bird who cares for her young. Yeah, but what about all of the fears that we have outside of us? Don't you know God's invincible power? He is your strong shield and he is your armor. Yeah, but I still don't trust you. He is the commander of heaven's armies who guards you and who upholds you. The topic of angels can quickly morph into some weird beliefs, right? It's probably a combination of like a post-Christian society that still has some kind of hunger and appetite for spirituality. And so wham, all of a sudden you have this ingredient for lots of talk of angels. We have bumper stickers that warn us not to drive faster than our guardian angels. It's good advice, isn't it? But this passage gives us some insight on who angels are to us. It gives us a theology of angels that's pretty robust. There is some truth here that the Lord guards his children and protects them through angels. Satan will quote Psalm 91 to Jesus, and he'll say, go ahead and throw yourself off the mountain and watch the angels bear you up, since aren't you the righteous one? And Jesus doesn't say, well, the psalmist was just being kind of literary. Jesus says, no, I'm not going to put the Father to the test. This isn't something we often talk about, but this insight was picked up a few years ago in an article that I found by a man named Greg Lucas, who was blogging about loving his son who has severe mental and physical disabilities. Years ago, I read an excerpt of this article, if this rings a bell to you, but I think it's one of the great applications I've found of this theology of guardian angels for our lives. Here's what he says. He says, I do not believe Jake has a guardian angel assigned to his disability to protect him from harm. I do believe, however, that he has a guardian father who sits on his throne in heaven, surrounded by an army of angels, intently watching the face of their commander in chief. And with one nod of the Almighty's head, a legion of angels could be dispatched to preserve and protect my son. Night and day they wait and watch the father's face as his eyes watch over Jake. So at 3 years old, he nearly drowned in a creek. The father nodded. The angels were dispatched. At age 5, he wandered out into traffic. The father nodded. The angels were dispatched. He would escape from the safety of his home and wander around the town vulnerable. And the father would nod and the angels would be dispatched. And then he concludes this post saying, I am reminded that God is on his throne at this moment. He has his eyes on my boy, and he has an army of angels who have their eyes on the face of my father. Jake is in good hands. Isn't that powerful? Isn't that applying Psalm 91? We don't have guardian angels. This isn't It's a Wonderful Life, right? But we have a sovereign, all-powerful God with a whole legion of angels at his disposal to protect those he loves and upholds. This passage brings us to ask, what do we fear? And can you see that God is bigger than your fears? Exhibit by exhibit, bringing us to see that God is capable and able, that he covers us with his wings, that he is a shield about us, that he is for us. Psalm 91 calls us to trust in the Lord as our refuge and shelter. The psalmist confirms exhibit by exhibit the absolute trustworthiness of God. And finally, we conclude with our last point, the Lord condescends to his people in grace and mercy. It's the voice of God. He becomes a speaker in the psalm. God concludes the psalm. He says, because he holds fast to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. It's a beautiful reminder of biblical religion, isn't it? It's not the holy and pure. It's not the righteous. It's not those who by their own works have somehow come into the presence of God. What qualifies you to be in the shelter of the Almighty is that you know him, that you know his name. It's a picture of faith, resting in God's promises. And I love the picture of faith that Psalm 91 gives us. It says, the one who holds fast to me in love. Faith looks like clinging. Faith looks like holding fast. Let me give you a picture of this, which I think hopefully can illustrate what this kind of faith looks like. My children are getting older now, but when they were little, I used to frequently go up the stairs with them, and I would tell them to hold on tight. And with their little arms, they would grab hold of my neck or they would grab hold of my arm and they wouldn't let go. And I told them, don't let go or you're going to fall. I'm going to let you in on a secret. They were not holding on to me. I was the one who was carrying them. I was the one who was supporting them. It was my arm that was under their body. And yet with their little arms, with as much strength as they could muster, they were clinging to me. And if I was not holding on, they would fall. That's what faith looks like. Those who hold fast to me in love, but God is the one who carries us. God is the one who holds us. God is the one who condescends to us. It's not a totally unfamiliar word, condescension, right? We have bosses who are condescending. Brothers and sisters who are condescending. When we're being nasty and we want to exude pride and puff up ourselves and put down others, we have a tone of voice ourselves that is condescending. But what a beautiful grace for the creator, majestic king of the universe to condescend to us, to stoop to us. The Lord delights to be called upon. So what does this mean for you in your life situations? Well, wherever you are, in a time of peace and prosperity, in a time of mourning and grief, in a time of fear, of sickness, of old age, of youth, would you call upon the God who comes to you, who stoops down to you, who calls you to trust in him? The whole point is to call you to trust in the Lord because of his trustworthiness, and he puts it on display for us, right? The question that we all have is whether God can be trusted or whether he is something real enough to trust. In Psalm 91, the majority of the passage is unpacking why and how God is trustworthy, and nothing's changed. God is still our refuge and shield and shelter and mother bird and commander of angelic hosts. And though our hearts are warmed by God as a hen who protects us and this strong shield that surrounds us and is about us, I think most of us are still wondering if Psalm 91 is really just filled with maybe naive pleasantries divorced from the real world. Is this presenting a fantasy that has nothing to do with real life? And I think that's a good question. I think it's a good question. So what do we do with Psalm 91 when it meets us in this very real world? I think, first of all, it's a psalm of trust, which means that it's grabbing hold of us and it's pulling us in. It's calling us back to trust in the Lord. It's a reminder that this is true, that God really is good and worthy and capable of being our refuge and strength. And so when we're overwhelmed by fears, it's helping us to ask, what are my functional shelters? What are the functional refuges that I seek out? And that's so much of our lives, isn't it? We seek our refuge and shelter in our identity as parents. And so our children have let us down. Our children have not lived up to what we want them to be. And we're crushed and we cry out to God and we say, why are you not my refuge and shelter? And it's as if God is saying in Psalm 91, why are your children? Why is your spouse? Why is your family life? Why is your career your refuge and shelter? And yet you turn back at me and point your finger. Where do I actually seek refuge? And is that why I'm falling apart? Is my joy in the Lord, or is my joy dependent on fill in the blank? Whatever it is that we seek for an identity, whatever we seek in our hard times as our refuges, as our shelter. And so Psalm 91 reorients our hearts back to God, who's capable and worthy. That's one thing. But Psalm 91 is doing more than just exposing our false shelters. It's also reminding us in the darkness. It's reminding us amidst life's trials that we are already right now in the shelter of the Most High. That his pinions never stop covering us. And this leaves us with some really difficult propositions to work through. At the end of the day, God is either a shield that can't catch all of life's arrows, or, and I think this is the better answer, and I think it's the right answer, or he is a shield that at times will allow life's arrows in for reasons that we cannot see. It's possible that evil will befall us. I'm sure for many of us, we already feel like evil has befallen us. Plagues don't only come near our tents, do they? They come inside the tents. Sometimes we don't feel very delivered or protected. And so is it possible that God allows these arrows of life in so that we experience pain in order to avoid greater pain? Sure, it's possible. Is it possible that God allows us to experience pain in order to capture our hearts with his goodness and with his glory? Absolutely, that's possible. Is it possible that we don't always have the answer, and sometimes we will never have the answer as to why he allows life's arrows in? And the answer mercifully to that question is yes. Yes. And this is when we need reminding to rely upon the presence of God and to reside in his shadow. These are the times when our creatureliness and weakness and helplessness is exposed, and the Lord draws us to himself as the only thing in our lives that last. See, Psalm 91 reminds us we will not always be spared life's hardships, but we will never be abandoned. We know we will never be abandoned because the Almighty One, remarkably, incredibly, not only entered our world, but he entered our suffering. See, Psalm 91 means something so different for you and I reading it this morning than when this song was first composed and sung, because there was one person who dwelt most perfectly in the shelter of the Most High and who abided in the shadow of the Almighty. And these words were forever changed when you hear them sung from the lips of Jesus. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. Did those words go through Jesus' mind as he carried his cross? He knew those words. He said those words throughout his entire life. Was he thinking of those words as he was spat upon, as he was rejected? He will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. Did these words come to his mind as he hung on the cross bleeding and mocked? I grew up with an old gospel tune which conveys a very beautiful truth. He could have called 10,000 angels, but he didn't. He died alone. How can we know and trust the character of God? How can you know and trust the character of God even amidst suffering and trials, even when you feel life's arrows hitting you? It's not only that the God of the universe testifies to his own sovereignty and commitment to you, it's that Jesus knew these words. Jesus internalized these words. Jesus said and sang these words, and he knew these words even on a Friday afternoon 2,000 years ago outside of Jerusalem city gates. But he didn't know them and say them and sing them just for himself. He sang them, he knew them, he spoke them for you. When Jesus held fast in love and received only a cruel death in return. When Jesus called out to his Father only to receive silence. I will be with him in trouble and rescue him and honor him were words that went unanswered to the only one who put his trust in the Lord perfectly. To the only one who found his Father to be his refuge and shelter. Why? For you. For me. So that when you're confronted with life's chaos and sickness and depression and loneliness and despair and really scary diagnoses and death and you realize that you have absolutely nothing, you will remember that you indeed have a refuge and shelter. That you have the incomparable inheritance to cry out to my God in whom I trust. And in a world that is ever fading away, quite literally, you will know that this security in your God is absolutely everything. It's worth mentioning that I'm sure if you're like me, we're far too easily tempted to listen to the counsel of the world that tells us either life is meaningless, right? That suffering and death are what they are, that the arrows of life are just, we try to suppress them, we try to buy our way out of them, we try to push them off to the periphery of our lives as best as we can, and we try to find our satisfaction in relationships or in stuff just to get by. In other words, find refuge in yourself. But friends, Psalm 91 is a heavenly announcement that calls us to turn from that lie to a God that will never let you go. It addresses us as sufferers. It addresses us in a world where catastrophes do happen. It addresses us in a world where we are sinned against and we are also the perpetrators of sin against others. It addresses us in a world where we are not always protected from disease and deaths and tragedies that inundate not just our news feeds, but also our Facebook feeds. The prayer requests from our closest friends. And it is precisely in this world that the Lord calls us again and again to hold fast, to cling to him, to trust in him, and to abide in his shadow. And so friends, find your shelter in the Most High God. Flee to him as your refuge. Be comforted even in this broken world that the last word belongs to God. And we know this is true because Jesus received silence for you. Not just in spite of your circumstances, but in light of them, trust in the Lord. Let your words be the great confession of this song, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. Let us pray.